Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. Today, we delve into the court system with Professor Gordon Ron. He's the director of the Innocence and Justice Project at the University of New Mexico Law School. He's currently teaching two classes, the Innocence and Justice Seminar and Wrongful Convictions. Students also do field work, where they learn the law of due process after someone is convicted of a crime. The project provides the time and resources to thoroughly evaluate cases under investigation. Prior to coming to UNM, Professor Ron led the Kentucky Innocence Project, which has helped exonerate 15 people convicted of crimes. Thank you for joining us today, Professor Ron.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
This fall, the Innocence and Justice Project will feature two speakers, one who was exonerated from death row and another who mistakenly identified a man after she was assaulted. They're going to join us today as well. First, I'd like to welcome Anthony Ray Hinton. Are you there, Anthony?
Yes, I am. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Anthony, you were convicted in 1985 of two murders in Alabama and spent 30 years on death row before being exonerated. What evidence was used to convict you?
Ballistics. The state of Alabama said that the gun that they retrieved from my mother's house matched the ballistic that they retrieved from the victim bodies, and they said that those and that alone was enough to convict me and sentence me to death. They was looking for a light-skinned black male with a full beard, and I fit that description of black male with a full beard. They came out to the house and arrested me and asked me, did I own a gun? And I told them no. And they said, well, do your mother own a gun? And I said, yes. And without any kind of warrant for the pistol or any kind of warrant, my mother gave them the pistol for them to take back and look at it. They had no fingerprint, no eyewitness, nothing but ballistics.
Now, the ballistics expert that your defense attorney hired for the trial wasn't qualified. He was blind in one eye. He admitted he had trouble using the microscope. And your attorney wasn't even aware of new state rules at the time that would have allowed him to spend money to hire a better expert. Your attorneys on appeal from the Equal Justice Initiative brought all this to light. But your case went all the way to the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, which found your original attorney, who's assigned by the court, was constitutionally deficient. And they ordered a new trial. What was it like for you to go through such a long process?
Well, I used two things to get through those difficult years, and that was my faith and my sense of humor. One would have to understand that I lived in a 5x7 for 30 years, and knowing that you're there for something you didn't do is really is unbearable as it is, but you have to find a way that you can cope with the legal system. You have to find a way that you can just get through the day. I just decided that I had to leave the place, and although my body was there, but I allowed my mind to just take me anywhere that I chose to go, and that's how I survived.
Finally, last year, the district attorney dropped the case against you when prosecutors could not match the bullets from the crime scene to your gun, or the gun that your mother had, and your conviction was overturned, and now you're free. What was it like knowing you were innocent on death row for 30 years, seeing other men being put to death while you waited, wondering what was going to happen to you?
One cannot understand watching other men, and I had the unpleasant of watching one female be put to death as well. The state of Alabama didn't care, and they knew all along that I was innocent. The state of Alabama had every intention of putting me to death. And that's why Alabama wanted to hurry up the process, executing people. And just being there, knowing you're not there for something you did, it was more frustrating than anything that I had ever been through. And every time we went to the courts would turn me down. And you get to the point where I said, man, I'm never going to be able to prove my innocence. Even when we got a qualified expert, they come back with the conclusion that the bullets did not match the way the state of Alabama said they did. We went before three attorney generals whose job is to make sure that the evidence that has been presented is the evidence is qualified and it is right. All three attorney general refused to re-examine the bullets to make sure that they was going to execute the right person. But they refused to just take 1 hour to re-examine the bullets. And so it scared me that I might die for something that I didn't do. And only through the United States Supreme Court, when they ordered that I was entitled to a new trial, then and only then did the state of Alabama go back and check their bullets. And that's when they decided that the bullets didn't match.
Thank you for sharing that with us, Anthony. I want you to stay with us for a moment. I'm going to turn to our next guest, Jennifer Thompson, who will also come to the University of New Mexico this fall to speak as part of the Innocence and Justice Project, as will Anthony Ray Hinton. Jennifer, you were assaulted in 1984 when you were a college student, and you picked a man out of a photo lineup, and you were sure he was the man who attacked you. And he was sentenced to life in prison. But in 1995, DNA testing found it was another man. Can you talk about why you were initially convinced you had the right person when you identified him?
It's hard to understand unless you understand memory. You know, if you had asked me in 1984, did we see things accurate and correctly and be able to encode them in our brains exactly as we see them, I would have said absolutely. But knowing what I know now, particularly when you think about people that are under trauma, people who are being assaulted with a weapon, which I was, it was a knife to my throat, what I've learned is at that point my ability to encode the truth was very, very skewed. I'm assaulted in the middle of the night. I've just woken up with someone in my apartment. There's a knife to my throat. He's threatening to kill me if I scream. And for 20 minutes, he rapes me. During the assault, I tried very hard to remember all the identifying features of this person, listen to his voice, pay attention to if there was a scar or a tattoo or anything that he couldn't alter later on, with the hopes that I would survive. I had not been drinking alcohol. I had not been using drugs. He was in close proximity to me in varying degrees of light, so I felt like I was able to get a really good look at him, not to mention the fact that I was intentionally trying to focus. I was able to escape and went, of course, into the hospital to have a rape kit, and it was there that I was beginning to give the description of my assailant, and the detectives felt that I had gotten a good look at the person who had raped me, which led to doing a composite sketch. And at that time in 1984, the police departments often used this technique called an identikit, and it was simply a file box of different parts of our faces. And my job was to look through each feature and pick out the eyebrows that I had remembered seeing, or the nose that I had remembered seeing, or the eyes. Through doing that, you put together, by overlaying these images across each other, the face. And when I'm asked, does this look like the person who raped me, the truth was yes, because it did. But the problem is, it looked like the person who raped me, but it wasn't the person who raped me. And at that moment, my memory becomes contaminated. So 3 days later, I'm called by the police to come down to the police department to look at a photographic lineup, and I'm 22 years old. I've never done anything like this before. I'm shown 6 photographs, and I'm trying to pull my memory of who my attacker was. But the problem is that my new memory now, which is a composite sketch, leads me to the photograph of Ronald Cotton, because Bobby Poole, the man who raped me, wasn't in that lineup. But what happens now is it's called relative judgment. You can start discounting certain photographs that you know don't match, and you pick the next closest answer, so to speak, like an SAT test. And once I picked out Ronald Cotton's photograph, and I'm given verbal affirmation, good job, Jennifer, that's who we thought it was, my memory now is forever, and I mean forever, altered.
So when he was exonerated in 1995 through DNA evidence, what was it like for you when you realized it was the wrong man?
It was the worst moment of my life. It was so much worse than the night that I was almost killed. It just destroyed me for about 2 years. I literally couldn't function. I mean, I honestly could not function. It would take 2 years for me to be able to find the ability to seek out Ronald Cotton and to meet him for the first time.
You guys have since written a memoir, I know, and become good friends.
Yes, and that changed my life again as well. I mean, that really helped me to begin my healing. It helped Ron to begin his healing. And what you realize is that both of you were victims of the same perpetrator. These perpetrators create an incredible amount of harm. And so Ron and I began to heal from that place of knowing that both of us had been harmed and both of us had been victims of Bobby Poole. And he had hurt a lot of people.
Jennifer, I want to thank you so much for sharing this story. I'm going to come back to you in a moment. I just want to say right now, this is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick, and we're talking about the Innocence and Justice Project at the University of New Mexico Law School. We just heard from Anthony Ray Hinton, who was exonerated after 30 years on death row in Alabama, and Jennifer Thompson, whose testimony helped convict a man for rape. He was later exonerated via DNA evidence. They will both be speaking this fall at UNM as part of the Innocence and Justice Project. You can find out more about that at our website, kunm.org. Professor Gordon Ron, I want to turn to you. You lead the Innocence and Justice Project at the UNM Law School. Anthony Ray Hinton was the 152nd person exonerated from death row in the United States since 1973. We've heard about the role of faulty eyewitness testimony and poor legal representation, how those can play in wrongful convictions. Are these common? What are the other reasons that these wrongful convictions happen?
Well, thanks, Megan. And eyewitness identification is the leading factor in wrongful convictions. It's a factor in almost 72% of the DNA exonerations. So it is the leading cause. We see other causes. We see ineffective assistance of counsel. We see false confessions. A lot of people think, why would anybody confess to something that they did not do? But it happens a lot. It's always difficult, and it's something that we talk with our students about, is that when we are reviewing these cases, that we have to keep an open mind, open eyes, open heart to the facts and let the facts lead us and not get focused on certain issues like a confession. So there's a lot of issues, faulty forensic evidence. That's been a cause in a couple of exonerations from here in New Mexico. And that could be based upon the changes in the science, you know, since the mid-80s.
When Jennifer was describing the process she went through in terms of creating a composite sketch, being asked to identify, are those things still the same or have those processes changed?
You know, it really depends a lot on the jurisdiction, but we still see the same way. The studies have shown that there are ways to minimize the risk of a wrongful identification, and it's really upon law enforcement, it's upon the state as to whether or not to adopt those reforms. Some states have, some jurisdictions have.
Talk about your program, where you guys come in this whole process.
Well, unfortunately, oftentimes we're the last hope. The applicants have already exhausted all of their state appeals. They have oftentimes exhausted the state habeas petition that they have gone to federal court and have been unsuccessful there. And that's why these things take
long. Are they often doing this without counsel?
Oftentimes, yes.
Because you're not, explain for our listeners, we're guaranteed constitutionally a right to an attorney up to a point.
That's right. You know, everyone has a constitutional right to effective assistance of counsel. And it's really a two-prong process in determining whether or not an attorney is effective in his representation. Did they act as a reasonable attorney would under those circumstances and in that type of situation? That's kind of easy to talk about. But then you have to prove prejudice, and that's a little bit tougher. So you have that right at trial, but once we get into post-conviction, that right to counsel is not there, and that's why so many inmates, exonerees, have had to do this pro bono, do it all by themselves, or pro se, rather. They do it by themselves. Many of them do not have access to law libraries, and they're doing the best that they can. And what we run into in doing our innocence work in the post-conviction stage is a lot of the issues have already been raised by the applicants. As laymen of the law, they do the best that they can, but it turns out it's already been adjudicated, and that can preclude us from getting into that same issue.
How many cases can you handle at any given time, and how does that compare to the demand for your services?
Oh, well, the supply and demand, the demand is much higher than we can offer on the supply side. The number of cases that we accept for investigation every year is based on the number of students that we have actually enrolled in the program. And at the University of New Mexico, given the nature of the project and the work that we do, the maximum number of students that we can have is 10. This year we have 8. So we have assigned 8 new cases for students to work on. We still have some cases that we're investigating that students in the past have picked up. And we have 4 cases right now working their way through the court system.
And how do they come to you? How do you decide which ones to take?
We typically will just receive a letter from an individual, maybe from their family, and we will provide them with an information packet about who we are, and what we do, and how we do it, and also provide them with a 20-page questionnaire, which asks for more information about their case. And they will give us a short summary of the facts of their case, and we're looking for those red flags, the mistaken eyewitness identification. Was there a confession? Was there a jailhouse informant, using one way of describing it?
What does that mean, that someone is conveniently saying someone did something because
it's somebody
they might get something out of it?
Yeah, they're coming in and saying, the individual confessed to me, we were cellmates, and this is what he said, and I want to deal on my charge. We see that quite often, unfortunately. So we are looking for those red flags. And once we have identified those, then we're looking to see which ones have the best chance of success, which may have the most merit. And we're also looking at cases that students can learn from in the investigation process. And the thing that we always stress to students is we encourage students who are interested in being prosecutors to participate in our programs, because they're the ones who are going to be making the decisions in the future as to whether or not a case is going to be prosecuted. And if they are aware how mistakes are made and where they come from, then hopefully they can short-circuit any problems before it happens.
What's been the reaction of the students involved in this?
Students love it. It's hands-on experience. The project at UNM actually started as a student organization, because students had been hearing about these exonerations across the country, and they wanted to be a part of that. And we had some exonerations in New Mexico back in the mid-70s, from death row. And so the students were aware of what was going on, and they wanted to be involved in it. We have had students who wanted to do patent law, who, after doing this, have changed their career path. We have former students who are working in prosecutor's office. We have former students who are working with the public defender. A former student is working with us, continues to work with us on one of the cases that is in court right now.
How is the project funded?
Right now, we are funded through a National Institute of Justice grant that was actually awarded to the New Mexico Department of Public Safety. The University of New Mexico is a subgrantee with DPS on that. And so we use that money to fund the position for a staff attorney and a paralegal, as well as cover the cost of our investigations, as well as DNA testing.
So prior to coming to UNM, you led the Kentucky Innocence Project, which helped exonerate 15 people. Any exonerations yet from the UNM project?
From the UNM project, no. In 2010, we began the restructuring process, and it takes a while to work through these cases. I mean, just like Mr. Hinton said, he'd been dealing with this for 30 years. A couple of cases that we're working on right now, we actually started working on in January of 2011. It takes a little bit of time to establish a project, to establish your footing and develop the structure. Our goal is, if the innocent individual is in prison, we want to be able to identify them, work with them in finding the new evidence, And hopefully we'll be able to have an exoneration soon. The last thing that we want to do is help a guilty person out of prison. So we're very careful in our investigations. We do a very thorough investigation and review so that we're at the point when we do request DNA testing or ask for relief based upon some other evidence that we're confident that we do have an individual who is innocent that we're working with.
You're listening to University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick. We're talking about the Innocence and Justice Project at the University of New Mexico Law School with Professor Gordon Ron. Professor, what about long-term structural change? Can your program address that? You mentioned you've already had some students who had a change of heart about
That's true. And that is one of the nice things about the Innocence movement is that we have been seeing reforms across the country. A lot of states have adopted some of the changes for eyewitness identification. Some states have adopted through legislature. Some attorney generals have taken it up. Supreme Court, I think it was in New Jersey, set out a long case addressing how eyewitness identification is to be handled in that state. So that has happened. We've also seen improvements in DNA testing statutes and preservation of evidence. New Mexico has a pretty solid DNA preservation and testing statute, but it wasn't adopted until 2003. So any evidence that may have been lost or disposed of prior to 2003 wasn't governed by any law or rule. It was all dependent upon law enforcement's policies and procedures. So we are seeing this innocence work, and that's where Mr. Hinton and Ms. Thompson are so important to this work, is appearing on programs like this, coming in and talking and sharing their stories so that others, not just us in the innocence work, can see how these things happen, how mistakes happen, and more importantly, how it can be corrected. You know, it's a human system. There's shortcomings. Humans are going to make mistakes. Fortunately, there is a process for correcting those mistakes. It's very high hurdle to overcome, but it's there. And it's through their help that we are beginning to see some of these changes come to fruition.
Now, you talked about some of the advances New Mexico's made, and we're also trying to address the backlog of rape kits that have not been tested, which could help victims as well as people who are wrongfully convicted. But we are also facing a debate right now in New Mexico about reinstating the death penalty after a series of murders, particularly a really gruesome child murder here. What can we glean from these stories when we're pondering whether we should do this?
It's an emotional issue, whether you're for it or against it. And I know there's been a lot of very emotional cases and offenses, crimes here in New Mexico lately. And, you know, it's heartbreaking to hear about those. But we have to be careful when we get too emotional and we react to things that happen and try and bring in something like the death penalty again. It's an uncommon conversation right now to be talking about reinstating the death penalty when many states are looking at abolishing the death penalty. So I think it's worth a discussion, but I think that we have to be really careful. Again, the system allows for the correction of mistakes, but you can't correct the mistake once the execution has taken place. There's a lot of things that need to be talked about when we're talking about reinstating the death penalty.
I want to finish going back to our two guests who will be coming to UNM this fall to speak. Jennifer, you and Ronald Cotton, as you mentioned, the man you identified who was later exonerated, you've become friends and you've written a memoir. How do you think we can prevent these kinds of wrongful convictions going forward?
There's a lot of ways we can help prevent it. I mean, Gordon touched on the eyewitness reform, giving public defenders and prosecutors equal power, equal financial resources, equal access to the same information. Transparency is very important. Honoring truth above winning cases is really important, and to have that conversation, but also accountability. I mean, we kind of live in a country where there really isn't accountability when there is egregious misconduct and negligence. I'm not talking about when someone, you know, has made a human mistake, but when we look at cases like Ray Hinton's, where it was egregious and malicious misconduct against you know, him and his family, and honestly, the survivor of the victim didn't get any justice at all at the end of the day. So there's different ways that, you know, we need to talk about all of this. We need to talk about false confessions and how that happened. We need to talk about jailhouse informants and snitches and why we even allow that. So there's lots of conversations that need to be talked about, and they need to be talked about with, again, truth and transparency, as opposed to trying to win or seek the next career move or an election.
Thank you, Jennifer. And Mr. Hinton, I want to give you the final word. What do you want to see change in our justice system so more people don't have to go through what you went through?
I would love to see, as Mr. Gordon and Jennifer said, and we need to talk about it. And it really saddened me just to hear that New Mexico is talking about bringing back the death penalty. You know, we have human error. We have politicians that wants to be tough on crime. But we have a law in this country that the prosecutors cannot be held responsible for their conduct. And if the prosecutor had been held accountable for the way they did me, I assure you, you wouldn't find not one prosecutor in this country that would be for the death penalty if they were to be held accountable for it. But when you give prosecutor a blank check to falsify evidence, to put liars on the stand, you don't do the victim family any great service by putting an innocent man on death row just so you can put a notch in your belt. That is not what it should be for. I just think we need to just sit down, and we ain't going to even get time to talk about the culture. If the prosecution going to spend $3 million, the defense should be given $3 million. That's how you even the playing field. As you know, and as you stated earlier in my case, my ballistic expert was given $50 to testify, a ballistic expert. What ballistic expert that you know of or anyone know of will take a case and testify for $50? But in the great state of Alabama, that's what he was given. And although it was ignorant of the lawyer that didn't know that he could act for more form, so we just need to debate this thing. We need to look at the cost that it would cost it to do a death penalty. And I think at the end of the day, if great people and great minds come together, we will all come to the conclusion that we really don't need a death penalty, because innocent people do go to death row every day in this country. And once you execute that person, you cannot bring them back. And I just think this is a subject that we need to really sit down and debate. We need to sit down with open-minded, and as hard it is for the victim family, we need to come up with the right, and we need to make sure we get this right.
Thank you so much, Anthony Hinton. And I just want to say thank you to all our guests today on University Showcase. Gordon Rahn, Director of the Innocence and Justice Project at the UNM Law School. Anthony Ray Hinton and Jennifer Thompson will be speaking this fall at UNM. I want to thank you both for coming on and speaking about this. You can find out more about their upcoming appearances at our website at kunm.org. This has been University Showcase on KUNM. Thanks to Roman Garcia for engineering today. I'm Megan Kamrick, and thank you for listening.